Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some legal experts warned against drawing larger political conclusions based on the verdict of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. But that didn't stop a lot of people from doing so. Coming up, we look at what advocates are saying about the acquittal and what it means for the Second Amendment, self-defense laws, racial justice, and other issues. First, with vaccines widely available, airline travel is expected to be up 80% compared to this time last year. With a surge in holiday travel, some airlines have brought back routes they canceled during the pandemic and added new ones. And in spite of a vaccine mandate for federal workers, the TSA has said it doesn't expect major delays. We're talking now about travel in the second holiday season of the pandemic, which will look pretty different compared to last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you traveling this holiday season after holding off on travel last year? Are you worried about COVID safety? Do you feel good about traveling at this point in the pandemic? In particular, I'd love to hear from you if you are flying soon or if you have been on an airline trip lately. What was it like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Megan Hart is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She recently wrote about the TSA and holiday travel. Megan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been keeping up with the TSA about compliance with the federal vaccine mandate and whether or not it's going to cause any delays at airports. What are they saying?
Sure. So I actually checked in with the TSA today. The vaccine mandate went into effect yesterday, and they say 98% of Customs and Border Protection agents are compliant with the mandate, as are 93% of TSA workers. So they are not expecting any delays.
And flights, I understand, are going to be up 50% compared to last year during this Thanksgiving week. Still, I think, lower than pre-pandemic, though. Can you tell us what the predictions are for what people are going to be doing when it comes to flying this next few days?
So I've recently checked in with a few different airports in Wisconsin, and it kind of varies depending on the airport. In Milwaukee, Thanksgiving flights are up 50% compared to last year, but down 7% compared to 2019. And they've got a bunch of new routes available this holiday season that were not available last year. But then if you look at other airports, Green Bay is pretty much back to normal, especially with the return of international travelers. Recently, international travelers who are vaccinated have been able to come to the U.S., and that's been a boost for Wisconsin airports. But then other airports like Madison haven't seen quite as dramatic of a rebound. They say traffic is still down about 40% compared to pre-pandemic time. And part of the reason for that is that's primarily a business airport, and they say that business travelers have been slower to return to flying.
When you talk to airport officials, are they giving any indication for travelers on, you know, show up earlier than maybe you used to in normal days?
Yeah, so I've got a lot of advice from the TSA and from airport officials. There's a lot they want people to know. In Madison, they did suggest arriving 90 minutes early for flights. In Milwaukee, 2 hours before flights. And Milwaukee also suggested booking and paying for parking in advance to ensure that you've got a spot if you plan to leave your car at the airport. And then they also wanted everyone to know that the mask mandate is still in effect on airplanes, so you need to have a mask. And then we've seen recently some airlines struggle with staffing shortages. So airport officials suggest that you download the app for the airline you're flying so you can stay up to date on any impacts that we may see during the holiday season. And then one other thing that we may not think about often, especially for people who didn't travel last year, is they said don't wrap your holiday gifts. So TSA agents do not enjoy unwrapping holiday presents, so pack them, unwrap, and wrap them when you arrive. And then finally, they just asked everyone to travel with their patients this holiday season, especially, some airports in Wisconsin primarily travel to destinations where people may be, larger airports where people may be connecting. And so airport officials say those larger airports might, you know, have some issues with staffing shortages at concession stands and things like that. So they suggested trying to be as patient as possible and packing some snacks.
Don't wrap the presents. Do pack the patients. I get it. Megan, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Sure. Sure, my pleasure.
Megan Hart is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She talked to us about the TSA's expectations for holiday travel this year. We're going to continue our conversation about travel during this holiday season, second one of the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have big travel plans? Do you have air travel plans? Or are you holding off, taking a wait-and-see approach? Or do you have a question for our next couple of guests, a couple of travel experts? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Deborah Dunn is the travel editor for Off Duty at the Wall Street Journal. Debbie, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And Barbara Peterson is a freelance writer covering air travel and a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, Barbara, let's start with you. We just heard what Wisconsin airports are expecting to see nationwide. What are you watching for when it comes to the number of people hitting the skies?
Well, this Thanksgiving season looks like it will almost be back to 2019 levels. That's obviously good news for the airlines. It, though, is not necessarily such great news for the travelers, because one thing that is different this time is that the number of flights, the actual number of departures that the U.S. airlines are operating, is still way down from 2019. So that's why when you get to an airport and you get on a plane, it seems awfully crowded. In fact, most flights are taking off literally 100% full. There are no middle seats at all, free, and that went by the wayside anyway. So anyway, yes, it is going to be very busy, but the airlines and the TSA say they're prepared. So we'll see.
Well, Deborah, that makes me think if I had dreams of getting a great airfare bargain, the math that Barbara just laid out there says maybe not so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, you really have to game it a little bit. And luckily, there are lots of websites to help you with that. So one that I really like is Scott's Cheap Flights. You can, set your favorite airport or your favorite 10 airports and see what kind of great last minute airfares are out there.
Now, how about a safety, Barbara? You mentioned those full flights going on. What do we know about what kind of precautions, what kind of things we should weigh before we buy that ticket or before we get on that plane?
Yes. Well, for air travel, I think most people should know that it is really very safe, considering, that you're traveling with a lot of people in a very small space. And the reason is that the airlines, and they did this before the pandemic, have very good filtration systems. And the air gets circulated from the ceiling to floor, not from front to back, which some people mistakenly think. And it, of course, makes you worry about it. Is this someone coughing 10 rows up? Are you going to get that? No. The airlines, and actually it's a federal requirement that all air passengers and crew wear masks. And there have been a number of notorious incidents this year about, people refusing to do so. And when they do, there are serious consequences. So it is really enforced. You should wear a mask and maybe pay a little more attention to what kind of mask. If you are concerned, get an N95 mask. Those are considered to be the most protection, or wear a double mask. Be aware of your surroundings. If you're at the airport, you don't have to join the scrum at the gate, at the same time everybody else does. And in fact, maybe while you're waiting for your departure, if there's another gate that seems kind of empty because there's no flight there, just move for a while to a less crowded space. So I do think that there are pretty much, they're common sense sort of precautions, but that should ease a lot of people's fears. And I would also remind listeners too that, if it was a serious risk, if air travel really was, the super spreader event, we'd be hearing a lot more about people getting very sick after flights. And we have not gotten that data this year. So the evidence suggests that it is actually quite safe.
Debbie, that's protecting our health. How about our wealth? If people are worried about buying an airline ticket because A, what if I get sick, or B, what if there's a big outbreak at my destination and I want to cancel because of that? What's the refund situation like these days?
Well, I think, okay, that's a, when you're shopping around for your flight, I think you need to be really careful about not booking a flight that you can't cancel. So the airlines have kind of stepped back, initially all the flights, none of the flights were, weren't stuck with anything, but now they've reintroduced sort of tiers. So I do think it's still pretty careful. You have to be pretty careful about not getting the cheapest ticket if you're at all concerned. And then, now is really the time to consider travel insurance. Especially if it's kind of an, if it's a pretty expensive trip and, you're at all concerned that things could change. I think it's really time to dig into the fine print of all those insurance policies.
We're talking to
And I
travel.
could just
Oh,
add
go
one
ahead, Barbara.
thing.
Yeah.
Just there that there is a type of travel insurance, as Debbie mentioned. Yeah, this is a great idea, but there's one that is called cancel for any reason. And I think that if you really want to be, totally, sort of comfortable with it, you could get that. It's more expensive, but a lot of airlines will not give you a refund, for getting sick. That's just not something they've heard that, they so that cancel for any reason is just an additional precaution if you're really concerned.
We're talking to travel writers Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson. You can see their work in the Wall Street Journal. We are looking at air travel this holiday season and beyond, the second holiday season of the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests about traveling in the next few days, in the next few months, or maybe planning ahead for an air travel destination in the future? Do you have suggestions of your own for making travel easier? Have you been on a plane in the last, I don't know, couple few months? What did you think of the experience? How were things flowing at the airport? Were things civil in the skies? Do you want to know how to prepare for your upcoming trip? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on how to travel safely this holiday season and beyond with Wall Street Journal travel experts Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson, and with you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about air travel in the next few days, the next few months for our guests? Maybe a recent experience? Do you have a ticket in your hand waiting to, or on your phone, waiting to travel soon? Do you have questions about the airport and airplane experience? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hello.
On your phone?
Hey. I have a question. I bought a ticket a while back for my wife and my stepdaughter to come over, but then they locked the country down, so we had to cancel. They gave us a voucher, and now that America opened up 2 weeks ago or whatever it is, they're saying that we have only a few weeks. It's like second week in December, I guess.
And where are they coming from, Tim?
Players. Pardon?
And where are they coming from? What country?
They're coming from England.
England. Okay. Tim, thanks for that call. I don't know if either of you want to take a stab at that one. They've got a voucher for a canceled trip. The clock is ticking, and it sounds like they can't actually travel in that time. Do they have any options?
Well, I can try to answer.
Sure.
I know that this is obviously, it's a lot of people are experiencing this, so you're not alone. What happened was, since it's been so long, nobody expected the pandemic to go for, almost 2 years. So yes, so a lot of these vouchers are, they're getting near the end of their sell by date. And the problem is that the airlines really are, they're not really helping a lot of people. And that has been the source of not just a lot of complaints, but the Department of Transportation actually had to get involved. So one thing I would suggest to you right away is, if you can't get much more satisfaction, you didn't mention which airline it is, file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Transportation, because if this is a flight that touches the United States, it is under U.S. Jurisdiction as well. They can intervene. Secondly, though, I would try to just move it up the chain at the airline that's involved, because I know from several people who you know, at first just felt that they were not going to get anywhere. They kept on, you know, asking to speak to a supervisor, moving and look to, you know, go up the management chain. And ultimately, you know, the squeaky wheel approach usually does work, because in both the cases I'm aware of, the people did ultimately get satisfaction. So what you need to do, though, is keep be ready to say a couple of possible dates, or at least a time frame, so they know that this isn't going to be something that you're going to come back in a few years. But you can, you know, if you can give them a sense of when you think you might, or your relatives might be using the tickets, that is helpful.
Tim, good luck, and thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Deborah, I want to talk about a while back you had written about, this is back during the summer, about, you know, good beach travel destinations at that point. If people are thinking, you know, not this holiday weekend, but out into the future, any good travel destinations that people can go to around the world, given current travel restrictions and maybe isn't too expensive this time around, where do you suggest people start looking?
Yeah, well, this isn't so surprising, but I still think Mexico is really, you know, there are so many flights to Mexico. There are so many destinations within Mexico. It's relatively affordable, still is. There's still availability even now, this late into the season. I think there are still hotels, you know, decent prices in Cabo and Cozumel, Cancun. I was just looking myself. So Mexico, Old Reliable, that still stands. And let's see, Dominican Republic, that's another one that was, you know, it's pretty easy to get to through most of this year, and it still is. And the testing requirements aren't too arduous, and there's a lot of great value in the Dominican Republic. And Puerto Rico, you don't have to test. You know, you can fly to Puerto Rico and you don't have to test back in to come to the U.S. That's a great sunny place. And Caribbean's a little trickier. You know, you really have to do your homework, because every one of the islands has a different testing entry requirements. But Jamaica, that's another one. And there's so many nice hotels. So there should still be some spaces, if not over the Christmas holiday, in January, February. Book now for March when it gets really cold and miserable. So there are lots of options.
We're getting some travel recommendations looking at safety when it comes to COVID-19 and air travel in particular. Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson are with us, travel writers. You can follow their work in the Wall Street Journal. Call in with your questions or maybe recent travel experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Barbara, you wrote, this is back in late August, about the Delta variant and how we assess travel safety. You were talking earlier about safety on the plane itself. You also wrote in that piece, you know, think about safety in the place you're going and the kinds of experiences you're hoping to have.
Yes, exactly. And also think about whom you're going to be sharing these experiences with. For that piece that you mentioned, I interviewed a number of infectious disease specialists. And one of them says what you really need to focus in on is are you visiting friends and family? Are you visiting anybody who's immunocompromised? Are you actually in good health, or do you have to worry about, you know, being in crowded spaces and things like that? And then, you know, assess each option. I know cruises, of course, really had a tough time in the pandemic because they basically were just completely scrubbed. And it seemed like that was going to be a tall order to get people to go back on cruise ships, you know, given all the factors, you know, that the fact that you're on a ship with a bunch of other people, you're really in close quarters. But it's come roaring back, and in part because the cruise industry, for the most part, is requiring all cruise passengers to be vaccinated and tested frequently during your voyage. I think that, you know, there are a lot of different ways to approach it, but just look at the factors, look at who you're going to be with, where, and, you know, of course, in a particular country and destination, what's the vaccination rate and what's the infection rate?
Let's go back to our Let's go back to our callers now. Nita is with us in Houstonsford. Nita, hi.
Hi. All right. Thank you for taking my call. This is very timely. I was just wondering if the booking sites are at all messed up, if anybody else has had any experience with this. I tried to book a flight out to Austin and a return flight. And what happened was I was able to, you know, normally book the departure, but then, it gave me the charge. And I, you know, I clicked the pay and it kicked me out and it sent me a confirmation for the departure, but it never gave me a chance to book the return flight.
So this is a booking site like the kayak sort of thing, Nita?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Deborah, we don't have too much time left. I want to throw that to you. Are booking sites, those third-party sites, working as planned lately?
It's a good question. And, I think there have been some screw-ups, but I always regardless of, now or pre-pandemic, I always like to book direct when at all possible. I just think when things go wrong, it's so much easier to sort them out when you're booking directly from the airline or the hotel company. And, sometimes if you're buying a package, it's kind of hard to get around that great deal. But I think it's just safer in general to go direct.
All right, Nita, I hope you can get that sorted out. Just a few moments left, Barbara. What are you watching for when it comes to travel numbers over the next couple of months?
Well, I think what we're really looking for is whether or not this trajectory that we're on now is going to continue in a positive direction. You know, their international travel is opening up in both directions. And, there was a lot of attention paid when we opened our borders or reopened our borders to people from Europe and elsewhere. But also countries around the world have been gradually doing that as well. The problem is that a lot of them, have differing policies, so that can be a little confusing. But I think that whether or not that's actually leading to this big surge in travel internationally is still a question mark. So I think that those are the numbers we want to look for. We want to look for bookings, and people tend to book further ahead for foreign trips. So, right now or in the next few months, people will be booking for spring and summer.
Thanks to both of our guests, Barbara Peterson and Deborah Dunn. They both write travel columns for the Wall Street Journal, looked at air travel during the second pandemic holiday. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Kyle Rittenhouse says his acquittal is a victory for the Second Amendment and self-defense. He gave his first interview since being found not guilty in the shooting deaths of two men during the Kenosha protests and riots last year that happened after the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse was facing 5 charges altogether. The jury acquitted him of all of them last week. He talked to Fox News' Tucker Carlson about what happened the night of the shootings, the lead up to the trial, and its conclusion.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial.
Right.
And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers. And thank God they came to the correct verdict of a not guilty.
Many on the left, for example, say if Rittenhouse had been a person of color, the verdict, the outcome would have been different. Some legal experts have been urging people to not read too much into the verdict, saying that it only applied to this specific case and wasn't a referendum on broader issues. But our next guest says our response to the trial means a lot for the future of self-defense laws and for the value of human life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Rittenhouse verdict? Should we read it narrowly as just a verdict in this case, or does it mean something? Does it mean something wider than just what happened in that courtroom? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. He teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. He wrote a piece on the trial for NBC News. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it's good to be here. Thank you.
How do you interpret the verdict? Is it just about the Rittenhouse case, or does it go farther than that?
Of course, it's both. I mean, obviously, from defendant's point of view, it's very meaningful. And from the victims in this case, it's very meaningful. And then it's also meaningful to the nation. Lots of cases in our history have had cultural significance that have lasting reverberations as to where we are in society, what the community standard is, and how much we value life, and how we expect encounters to go between people. And so that was all in the debate, and obviously in the public debate. We saw that in the social media. There's a very vigorous discussion on both sides of the equation in terms of those who are obviously wanted to see Mr. Rittenhouse be prosecuted and convicted and those who wanted to see him go free.
In that piece I mentioned, you talked about that idea of a community standard when it comes to arguments of self-defense. And you point out there's a legal standard, but when you've got a bunch of people in a jury, they are interpreting that legal standard based on community values. So you think it is very worthwhile to look at the wider implications. Can you talk a little more about that?
I don't think, my guess is that the divisions that we see in Kenosha and then in Wisconsin and then in the nation regarding Mr. Rittenhouse's trial and our approach to what we view valid self-defense to be was also reflected in the jury room. I imagine the jury was somewhat reflective, had some representation of reflecting these divisions. So the jury is us. We are the jury. I think in terms of this particular statute, there's not a whole lot of guidance for a jury. The jury is asked to determine whether or not Mr. Rittenhouse's actions were reasonable and whether his fear of great bodily harm or imminent threat of death was reasonable. And, you know, I think they probably took his age into consideration, and there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion of his age. I personally think that we should not have been prosecuting him as an adult. I think that he should have been prosecuted as a juvenile, or at least processed as a juvenile. And so for me, I was caught between two aspects. One, my deep concerns about how we approach juveniles in the criminal justice system. And then the other one is how we define self-defense, just generally for all adults, regardless of age, once you age into being an adult.
You also wrote about one outside expert brought in early in the prosecution process here, talking about self-defense claims for someone who has a firearm, being able to raise the concern that someone else might take that firearm and then use it against them or others. So that by showing up with a firearm, in effect, you may be raising your right to make a self-defense claim even more?
Yeah, I think that's apparent from the verdict. I think it was an extraordinary moment, but one that I think is deeply ingrained in the narrative of those who believe that they have a right to self-defense by carrying openly firearms in society, regardless of the situation around them. And so, yeah, I think that there is a big issue here. The expert actually said, under questioning by the prosecutor, if Mr. Rittenhouse had not been armed and was approached in the exact same way by Mr. Rosenbaum, that first incident in which this man who was suffering from mental illness threw a plastic bag and obviously aggressed, he definitely aggressed on Mr. Rittenhouse, would it have been reasonable for example, Mr. Rittenhouse at that point to use deadly force, either, let's say, through a chokehold? And the expert said no. And I thought that's an extraordinary moment. In other words, if Mr. Rittenhouse had been unarmed, from the point of view of this use of force expert, he would not have been privileged. But since he had a firearm, he was privileged to use deadly force despite facing the exact same quote-unquote threat from Mr. Rosenbaum.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hello.
Hello. He created the danger, Rittenhouse did. He's walking down the street with a long gun. He's a kid. And what I find shocking and frightening is that people that have a legitimate reason to protest the shocking shooting of that young man, now it's gone from being able to shoot black men on the street to shooting people that stand up to protest the abuse. And it seems like that's all right in this country. If you're black or you're someone that defends people that are black, you can now be shot with no consequences. It's horrifying to me.
Jordis, thanks for the call. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, those concerns resonate with me in lots of different ways. I mean, you know, I really resonate with those comments. But, you know, the law in Wisconsin, which was really surprising, that it doesn't permit minors like Mr. Rittenhouse at 17 years old to walk around with dangerous weapons. But if you look deeply into Wisconsin law, and this is not to push back against the caller at all, it was just who we are. I'm talking about who we are as however terrifying that might be, what is our identity, that our law right now permitted Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around at 17 years old with a long rifle, more than 26 inches in length. So he was actually permitted to do what he did. Now, of course, it's not a good idea. Anyone with maturity or empathy or any kind of racial sensitivity would not, being certainly a white young male with a military garb and a gun, go into a protest regarding a previous shooting of a black male by a white cop. That's so harmful to do to a grieving community anyway. And so that aside, which I found more than troubling, that we have laws that actually permit Mr. Rittenhouse to walk around with that long gun. I was still surprised that, you know, Mr. Rittenhouse was not even detained, and maybe I wasn't too surprised, but again, troubled that Mr. Rittenhouse was not at least detained by an officer that night, just because he looked so young to be carrying a gun and to check ID, and that didn't even happen. And some respect, that really reflects where we are as a society, that we have police who are, I guess, are accustomed or so accustomed to the idea that a young man like Mr. Rittenhouse has a right to carry an AR-15 around at night during protests is extraordinary to me.
Before we go back to our callers, I want to ask about the Ahmaud Arbery case in Georgia. Again, claims of self-defense being made by the defense team there after Mr. Arbery was pursued. The suspects pushed him off the road basically with their truck, leveled guns after him. When he tries to defend himself, they shoot him, and there's a claim of self-defense being made. We don't know yet. Of course, the jury just started deliberating today. Do you have thoughts on that case?
I do. I mean, there's some underlying similarities between that case and the Rittenhouse case in terms of the idea that for the defense, they're trying to argue that somehow that this was protection of the community against someone who's doing harm to the community. So in Mr. Rittenhouse's case, it was against arsonists and rioters and those who would burn things down and create, harm to others through rioting, I guess. And then, you know, in the Mr. Arbery case, it involves three individuals who are claiming to protect the community from some kind of burglary. In fact, the defense counsel used extraordinary language, the word plunder, to describe what Mr. Arbery was doing. There are some differences as well. Mr. Rittenhouse, at least as to the first incident, was aggressed upon. I would not characterize the second incident involving these three other individuals as aggressing upon Mr. Rittenhouse at all. But when you look at the Mr. Arbery case, oh my gosh, I mean, he was pursued. He was pursued. He was terrorized by multiple people in trucks with guns. I can't believe the kind of fear he must have been going through. That was just absolutely pure aggression and violence and, you know, the racial kind of aspect to it. And it being in the South, really reminiscent of vigilantes taking their matters into their own hands and just basically using their race privilege to kill a black man. It was really, really different in that particular respect.
We're talking about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, what it means for claims of self-defense and other issues. Ian Main stays with us, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a wider meaning, a wider lesson in the outcome of this trial, one you like or one you don't like? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking another look at the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse. A lot of legal experts urge people not to read too much into the verdict, saying it only applied to Rittenhouse's specific case. Others seeing wider lessons in the verdict. Ian Main stays with us, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison, where he teaches civil procedure, civil rights, and wrongful convictions. Let's go back to your calls now. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Hey, I think your guest makes a number of valid observations that go beyond the case. But to me, I think Rittenhouse now typifies the warped thinking of people who believe if they have a powerful firearm that they're invincible. He goes to this mass meeting or protest and probably suddenly realizes Wisconsin has concealed carry, and then fear takes over. And then the firearms just accelerate the damage. I frankly think he was afraid. And I don't know how he'll ever get away from the fact that two people died because of his warped thinking.
Bob, thanks for the call. What do you think of that, Ian, and the idea of the presence of firearms in this case accelerating, our caller says, the danger?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Bob said. I think it was a really rich comment. And I agree with those observations. I do think that it does accelerate and escalate the violence that was used. And again, I think because he had a firearm in the way that we are understanding self-defense these days, that he had more discretion to use deadly force against those he felt in fear of than he would have if he had been unarmed. And we can debate back and forth. I mean, I certainly would think that he would not have been aggressed upon if he hadn't had a weapon. So there's also that aspect of escalation, that the presence of weapons absolutely raise tensions and increase the possibility for violence. And so to not take responsibility for you carrying you exercising your Second Amendment right as if it doesn't have any cost to society, I think is highly irresponsible. I think if you're going to believe that you have a right to do something, you should be really aware of the cost that it does have, not only to others, but possibly to yourself. And as to yourself, I think Bob is right. As to Mr. Rittenhouse, I mean, he's a young kid still, and he's being propped up by adults. But at a certain point, he's going to be, by himself, and for a long time, will be have to face these things that he did, and that is a huge amount of trauma and a huge weight, and it's not going to go away. And so, to take these things and these narratives like self-defense and I have the right to carry and things like that is really, in the end of the day, really has a lack of empathy and maturity and vision about what really is going on. We are humans. We interact. We're very affected by someone who's next to us carrying a weapon. And it changes the way we interact with each other. And it's unfortunate that that's the direction that we're going in our society.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We'll go now to Andy in Madison. Andy, hi.
Hi. I was kind of struck by what your guest said about saying that the law does allow him to carry a weapon because it wasn't a shortened one. The law is pretty clear that they can only carry the weapon in a hunting situation. And the judge basically pretended not to understand what the word or meant. So does your guest agree that the statute was vaguely written, or is he saying that because the judge ruled this way, that's now the way of law?
Interesting. John, Ian, was this a twisted rendering, a reading of the law, or is it just a, a gap in the law.
Yeah, again, I agree with John as well. I think that this particular law did have some failure in its drafting, and it wasn't clear. And obviously the defense capitalized on that. And, you know, regardless of how we view this judge, I mean, all judges have bias one way or the other, but this judge in this particular situation took very seriously the judicial canon that we strictly construe criminal statutes. The prosecution made a very strong argument that we need to read statutes in a way that that make sense of the statute and don't create exceptions that would swallow the rule, as this particular exception under C3 would. I understand the language and the debate over that or, but I wouldn't say that it's completely outside the, you know, a reasonable interpretation that the judge took. I don't agree with it, but I understand, you know, if I was on the prosecution, I'd be happy to argue why it only relates to hunting issues. But one could read the statute in another way, and that's how the judge read it. And it was a drafting error or not by the state legislature. I don't know.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Ian Main, assistant professor of law at UW-Madison, looking at possible wider outcomes, meanings of the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict late last week. Back to your calls now. Nadine is with us in Milwaukee. Nadine, hi.
Hi. I have three issues. First of all, now that he is found innocent, he could conceivably go to the police academy and become a police officer. And while most of our police officers are wonderful, we don't need another one who thinks that they have a license to kill. Second, I didn't hear any remorse or any accepting of responsibility in his voice. And I'm concerned that he does think he has a license to kill now and will go out and do this sort of thing again. And thirdly, I'd like to see this judge recalled.
Nadine, thanks for the call. We can only speculate about Kyle Rittenhouse's future or his, I guess, psychological state. Ian, your thoughts on the judge, people who, especially those who disagreed with the verdict, very critical of the judge's handling of the trial.
I understand that. And, you know, there was a media presence here and cameras going the whole time. Certainly what I saw as a criminal law litigator who's practice in all over the state of Wisconsin and also in high level cases like homicides. You know, there's a wide range of judging styles. I will say that I've certainly had my day where I've been on the receiving end of a judge's ire. I understand that there was, you know, reasonable allegations of bias by this judge as to this case. There were some decisions that went well for the prosecutor, and there were some decisions that went well for the defense here. In terms of kind of the bell curve, I understand people's anger regarding this judge. I've certainly felt internally angry about the way I've been treated in the courtroom by a judge. I've certainly been screamed at. I've been screamed at in open court. I've been screamed at in chambers. I felt bad for the prosecutor for being yelled at on national TV, but the interaction itself seemed well within the bell curve. Given my experience, this is not to say this behavior is appropriate. All I'm saying is that this behavior is not outside the bell curve.
Thanks for the call. In just our last minute, Ian, do you think we need to revisit things like our self-defense laws in this country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there needs to be clear guardrails about what force can be used. I think that we should not privilege those who have firearms any more than if they had been unarmed. So I think self-defense laws should assume that the person would have been unarmed, and that as an unarmed person, would they really have thought there was going to be a deadly threat? So it would be imagining Mr. Rittenhouse again without having the AR-15. Would he have been privileged to use deadly force? If he had not, then In my thinking, he should not be privileged. I don't think a gun should give you additional discretion to use violence against other civilians.
Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Ian Main is an assistant professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse on murder charges and what it means for larger societal and policy questions, especially related to claims of self-defense.